It is 8:30, and we are joined once again by Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
No Maria this morning?
No, Maria actually had a trip to the emergency room yesterday afternoon, but she's doing better now.
Yeah.
But she's resting at home.
She is.
Probably resting asleep and not even listening to us.
Yeah. The nerve.
I know, no kidding.
So,
she'll have her chances in the future.
Yeah. I have no doubt about that. So, coverage of the budget, Bush's budget for the coming year.
Yeah, we knew this was coming. President Bush had talked about doing some fairly severe cuts to try and balance the budget. Of course, he's not actually balancing the budget, because the most notable thing that was in his budget proposal, which came out on Monday, and then he had some additional details that he released yesterday as to what some of those cuts look like. But the most notable thing is what was not included in the budget. No cost for the wars in Afghanistan or Iraq. No cost for Social Security privatization. So that's, you know, the $2 trillion that it'll cost under Bush's plan to partially privatize Social Security, nowhere to be found in the budget. The cost of Iraq and Iran, nowhere to be found in the budget. These are things that are going to, push the budget over into the red once again. And then, of course, we have had the brouhaha that's come up in the last few days of the cost of the Medicare drugs being much higher than was expected. Congress was sold a couple of years ago when this passed that the cost of the drugs would be about $400 billion, and now it looks like it's going to be more like $740, which is what critics were saying at the time, was the costs were going to be much higher than the White House was saying, and the White House was lowballing it. So in that context, the context that that those costs are still steadily going up, what Bush's budget looks like is more money for the Pentagon and less money for everything else. We have $4.7 billion going to be cut from education costs, $1.7 billion from health care, $1.5 billion from law enforcement, $500 million from housing, $2.5 billion from agriculture. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And some cuts that really were quite significant in terms of us here in the Northwest, particularly the Bonneville Power Administration. What the White House would like to do is not take away the energy subsidies per se, but have the power costs in the Northwest, the four-state area that's served by the BPA, more closely reflect market rates, because the costs right now are among the lowest in the country because of the hydroelectric power that's generated by the Columbia River Basin dams. What the White House would like to do is take money to have those rates be more what the rest of the country, like the Northeast, where energy is much more expensive, pay. You would like us to pay what they pay, and use that money to help contribute toward reducing the budget deficit, which is essentially, as Maria Cantwell said, an additional tax upon the citizens of Washington State and Oregon and Idaho and Montana. And this is something that that Murray and Cantwell and other politicians and the federal politicians in the Washington State delegation in Oregon and so forth have said they would fight tooth and nail. And a proposal that has been made before. It was made during the Reagan administration and shot down then. But something that would definitely affect the pocketbooks of everybody here in Seattle.
Well, not that I'm proposing that my electric rates go up, because they're already high enough for me, but what is the thinking behind why we even get subsidized here in the Northwest?
Well, the subsidy is in the is in the hydroelectric power, and to be honest, I don't know what the original rationale for it was. But the fact is that the energy is much lower to the actual costs of producing it are much lower than costs elsewhere in the country, and they're talking about having the rates be much higher than the actual cost of production, and that's the point at which it isn't the subsidy per se, although that's in danger too, obviously, but it's the above and beyond that, the cost that that Bush is proposing that is generating so much rancor amongst lawmakers.
Generating.
Yes, generating, exactly. So we're going to see a lot of those cuts to the Forest Service, to the agriculture, to the EPA, a lot of those cuts toward the less fortunate in society, the social services going toward the poor, the disabled, the elderly. These are cuts that that are not going to affect the traditional wealthy Bush constituency, but they're going to affect everybody else.
All right. So anything else on that budget?
Afraid not. This is something that will go to Congress right now. And, of course, Congress being Republican-dominated, there will be some back and forth, and there will be some additional pork that will be laid on, but a lot of those cuts are likely to survive.
Okay. Well, let's jump to over to international, and this week in Iraq.
After a little bit of a lull in the violence in Iraq after the election, it started to go back up again this week. We've had several incidents even just in the past couple of days. 12 people dying in a car bomb in the town of Balim Ruz, north of Baghdad. A bakery shooting in Baghdad, killing 11 people on Friday. This morning in Musayib, a town south of Baghdad, another 17 people killed in a car bomb. And these are bombings that have been targeted at the Shiite civilian population. It's seen as an effort by the primarily Sunni insurgency to exacerbate the intra-ethnic tensions between Sunnis and Shiites. And this is something we're probably going to be seeing more of in coming weeks. One of the reasons for exacerbating the tensions and the reason for that as a strategy is the results of the election itself. We have not yet seen the actual results, but when they come in, they're likely to have almost no representation for the Sunni minority within the national government of Iraq, and this is something that's going to lead to an awful lot of tension. Wanted to talk a little bit about why we haven't seen those results yet. They're going to go back and recount about 300,000 of the ballots for spoilage and suspected fraud. But above and beyond that, what we're seeing is an effort by the United States to delay as long as possible announcing what the actual turnout was in Iraq. Because the turnout was much lower than was originally reported. It looks right now like the turnout was barely more than a third of the population of eligible voters in Iraq, about 34-35%, as opposed to the original 72% that was reported by the Iraqi government, and then it was moved to 60 and then the upper 50s, and it keeps declining. And, of course, the turnout was near zero in the Sunni areas of Iraq. So this is something that the United States and the Bush administration is basically trying to delay for as long as possible, release the vote totals by which people can see the actual turnout in Iraq so that by the time it does come out, it will be considered old news and not particularly newsworthy and so on and so forth. This is something the Bush administration has gotten quite good at in terms of burying the bad news from Iraq. The next step in that is to determine who the prime minister is going to be, and there's already jostling going on between various Shiite elected officials within the Ali al-Sistani, the Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. I can't even say it this morning. Plank that or group of people that was elected. They have, according to the preliminary results that have been released so far, gotten nearly two-thirds of the vote. So this is something that will probably stand up in the upper 50% even after the votes from the Kurdish North are counted, which is one of the primary areas that's been missing so far.
Yeah, I know the Bush administration had, for their success numbers for the election, they had picked 50%. He had said, we get 50% or more, then thumbs up. And
it looks like they did not make that total. They got a very high turnout among expatriates from people in parts of the world other than Iraq. It was well above 90%, but within Iraq itself, they didn't do nearly so well.
All right. Well, jumping back to, well, sort of this neck of the woods, North America. Several articles this week about Walmart and a particular store they have up in
Jonquière, Quebec.
Jonquière.
Yeah, it's up in north of Quebec City, it's a pretty remote area. But it has made the news this week because the workers there decided to unionize, and Walmart decided to close the store rather than allow the union to take effect. There was a hilarious headline. I forget whether it was this morning or yesterday in the paper that's saying Walmart says unions aren't necessary for its workers. It's classic corporate paternalism. We can take care of our workers okay. They're bright, they're happy, they're smiling, they're shining, and they don't really need a union to help look out for them. But this is something, Quebec in particular is a very, very highly unionized culture. The union there is saying that they are not going to be deterred. They're going to try and unionize more Walmart stores. And Walmart can't close all of its stores. If the union keeps organizing store by store, it's going to be kind of a face off between Walmart following this tactic of closing stores rather than allowing them to be unionized, and the union saying, this is something that workers have an absolute right to be able to do.
My understanding is in Canada they've had a much more success with at least attempting to unionize at Walmart than they have here in the U.S.
Yeah, that's true. Of course, Canada is more unionized in general than the U.S. is, and I don't think there have been any Walmarts that have been successfully unionized in the United States. Is that true?
Yeah, as far as I know, that's true. And this was the first one that looked like it was going to be unionized anywhere, and that's why they're trying to shut it down. So, all right, jumping over to school districts, California, badges. We don't need no stinking badges.
Yeah, we don't need no education. This is a really kind of a scary story from a town northwest of Sacramento called Sutter, California, where the school district there, it's a one school in the entire district, an elementary and junior high school, and they have decreed starting in January that all of their students have to wear electronic badges around their necks, and a little rope around their necks so that they're going to be – it's the same kind of technology that's used to track cattle in stockyards, to track inventory in factories, and they want to do it in order to be able to take attendance and to be able to maintain discipline in the school. And of course, the ACLU is all in a huff over this for some obscure reason. Who would know why? It really is kind of a scary story. It's treating kids like cattle. This, mind you, is in a relatively rural district where there aren't particularly disciplinary problems. This is not an inner city school somewhere where there's gangs and shootings and all the rest of the kind of things that come with urban districts these days. So it's not entirely clear what the rationale is for this, except that the company that manufactures this technology, I believe it's called InGel or something like that, is actually located in the same town. And so there's also a question of the financial dealings between the company and the school district and whether this is something where money passed hands under the table or something of this sort in order to get them to try and adopt this technology. But we're going to see more and more of this because there's absolutely no reason why this same technology can't be used for workers in a workforce, for example. Certainly for convicts in prisons, it's almost the same sort of thing as the ankle bracelets they use for home detention, same sort of technology. But reinforces the idea that kids in school are basically attending a medium security prison in a lot of cases. It's a scary, scary story.
Yeah, you brought up the economic aspect. One has to wonder with schools being so tight on budgets and stuff, where they would get money for an expensive program like that. And it sounds like you already answered that question because the company's right there in town. But did you hear if there's any opt-out option via the parents saying that, no, I don't want my child participating.
There wasn't any mention of that in the story at all, no. I don't believe there is.
All right. All right, well, moving along, I didn't hear about it, but you did. There was a memo released this week from Richard Clark.
Yeah, this was a memo that was declassified this week that was sent by Richard Clark in January of 2001, immediately after Bush took office, and on the day that Condoleezza Rice became National Security Advisor, he had sent a memo to her that contained a short-term and a long-term plan for dealing with the Al-Qaeda and the terrorist threat. And this is something that Clark had made reference to both in his book and in his testimony before Congress, and that the White House had disputed, saying that we didn't sit on our hands, we were ready to take action, we saw what the Clinton administration had did, we didn't think it was adequate. The memo in particular called for a meeting of principals, which is to say that the department heads and the cabinet level to talk about the terrorist threat. Clark wanted this to happen immediately. It actually didn't happen until September 4th, 2001, only a week before 9/11. So the White House didn't do anything about that for a period of 8 months, more than 8 months. When the White House has been saying all along that they were acting promptly and working on this. So this is one more document, and there's been a series of them that have been released over the past year or so that have bolstered what Clark said under testimony. He has not yet been shown to have been stretching the truth at all in any of his testimony. He seems to have quite a bit of credibility at this point.
All right. Well, another item that came up this week that I had read was in dealing with the journalists and White House paying off journalists to, mm-hmm. Produce basically propaganda. Journalist, and I use that in quotes, who was a writer for a outlet called Talon News, which is an internet news provider, gentleman named Jeff Gannon, who was getting exclusive access to the White House daily briefings.
Yes.
And turns out that he has left his position there because some people with some competing internet news providers have pointed out that he was, in fact, tossing softball questions, very leading questions.
Leading questions,
right,
easy questions, yeah.
Like people like to press guy Scott McClellan. And he had been getting this exclusive access under a pseudonym there at the White House, which is intriguing.
How do you do that? How do you do that when you have to go through Secret Service security clearance in order to get into the same room as the president?
Well, that's what some Congress people are asking that now. They've sent a letter to the White House asking for clarification on the White House's use of news outlets and news people specifically for these type of purposes. So
it's not even enough now that they're paying off journalists or that they're producing videos that purport to be news of their own volition, when in fact it's not news at all, as propaganda. Now they're imitating the journalists themselves.
And apparently during the press conferences.
Yeah. So. That's kind of scary.
So that more on that should be unfolding as time goes on. 2004 was a warm year.
Yes, it was. This was something that NASA announced this week, that 2004 was the fourth warmest year in the history since they began keeping track of the world's climate in the 19th century. Now, this comes on the heels of 2003 being the third warmest year in world history, and 2002 being the second warmest, and 1998, a year in which there was a very strong El Nino current coming over the Pacific, was the warmest year in history. So you can dispute it all you want, but global warming is with us. It's something that's very clearly and very definitely happening. Now, interestingly enough, Greg Nichols, in his otherwise very boring State of the City address this week, talked about Seattle taking on the Kyoto Protocol. and doing things, and this is something that the state of California and various cities on the West Coast and San Francisco and LA in particular have talked about doing in the wake of the White House doing nothing to try and curb emissions and otherwise do something about global warming. Nichols talked in his State of the City address this week about the city of Seattle trying to take steps to reduce emissions and to adopt some of the aspects of the Kyoto Protocol, which I thought was actually a very good idea.
I thought that was good too, until I read that Seattle City Council had actually proposed just that a year or so back.
Yeah, they had a resolution in, I think, 2001. It's actually longer ago than that. That said that they wanted to uphold the Kyoto Protocol, and they've had public education programs since then also. So there was a priceless quote from Richard Conwin saying, "I don't think the mayor's aware of what the city has actually been doing." But it was, it still was good that he brought it up and that he put his backing behind that initiative.
Definitely, we appreciate anything good.
We're desperate. there has to be something good.
All right, and Eastside is looking at Eastside of where we are now, Eastside of the Lake, the Bellevue 8th district is looking at getting a new representative in there.
Yeah, there was a new representative on county council this week. His name is Reagan Dunn. He has gone through life with that unfortunate first name because he's the son of Jennifer Dunn, who named him after the then former governor of California and future president. He's only 33 years old, so he was named in the early 70s. But he had been working for the U.S. Attorney's Office, and he stepped down in order to take on the position on county council that was vacated when Rob McKenna was elected to become Attorney General. Now, this is a position that's going to basically disappear when the county council goes from 13 to 9 members in another year or so. That district is going to be melded into Steve Hammond's district on the south side of the east side. Enumclaw and Newcastle and areas like that. So the question at this point is, having given up his job for really a temporary 11-month appointment, is Reagan Dunn going to run for council next year? And he's saying basically that yes, he is. He's going to be running against another incumbent. He's not going to say who that other incumbent is, whether it's going to be Steve Hammond, whether it's going to be Jane Haig. There's a possibility of David Irons moving into Hammond's district also, because he's being thrown into a race against Kathy Lambert. All of these are Republicans on the east side. So it's going to be a matter of attrition among the Republicans on the county council next year. But this is a very powerful name to be throwing into the mix. Jennifer Dunn, his mother, is still a very powerful figure among GOP circles on the east side, of course being the former congressman and before that a state party chair. So another Republican in the mix to worry about.
All right. Well, we were going to throw this in last week, but we ran out of time. And since we got about 5 minutes left, I thought I'd throw this at you this week. We from time to time get thoughtful letters written into us in response to things that we talk about.
Yeah.
And this was an email from a regular listener, and he was I'll just read you this. On last weekend's edition, which is actually 2 weeks ago now, of Eat the Stage Up, Parrish talked about how Mayor Nichols had designated an area bounded by 47th and 50th Streets, University Way, and Roosevelt for increased occupancy. Mr. Parrish was fairly upset that single-family housing would be destroyed to make way for high-rise apartments and condominiums. His gist seemed to be that this was very unjustified and would harm lots of people. I might be wrong about this, but I don't recall this area of the University District being rife with standalone housing. If I'm wrong, fair enough. I've always enjoyed his reporting, but must admit that this seems rather alarmist. Since this is particularly the case in that the alternate to tearing down some standalone housing to enable us to put more people in the same footprint is what we need in Seattle, unless Mr. Parrish would rather we continue to sprawl our way outward with the attendant increase in single occupancy vehicles transporting all those suburbanites to their work and school. Would you ask him about this? So I'm asking you about it.
I wish we had a talk show. I wish we had time to go into this sort of thing every week. This is a classic debate that is had in terms of sprawl versus density. And one of the reasons why I thought this was a bad idea has to do not only with the fact that people are being moved out, but who is being moved out, because it's a question of gentrification. This is a student neighborhood. This is a neighborhood of, unless students come from wealthy families where they can, afford, market accommodations in the city of Seattle, which are fairly expensive on a student income. There are fewer and fewer places where students at the University of Washington can live off campus. And this is something where they and other low-income people are going to be driven out of a neighborhood that until fairly recently was a haven for people who needed lower-cost housing. This is something that's been steadily disappearing in the U District. Even in the 1970s and 1980s, you had quads, you had areas where... that whole area north of Fraternity Row, where you had these big old houses, where you had probably 20 students living. You have all of this housing in the University District, apartment buildings, and all the rest of this that can be dense, but it's dense with low income housing. And this is not what's being proposed here. What's being proposed here is condominiums. It's the old Norm Rice urban village vision that's very much gentrifying the neighborhood. So it's not just a question of density, although that is a problem too, because when you're driving out low-income people, we've seen this process already where they're being moved out of the city. They're going to Kent, they're going to Auburn, they're going to inner ring suburbs, and essentially helping the sprawl process, because when they move into those neighborhoods, people who already live there are moving even further out. They're moving to Issaquah, they're moving to North Bend, they're moving to Maple Valley, and so forth. And this is how you get sprawl. It's not somebody in Seattle suddenly deciding they're gonna move out to the Snoqualmie Pass. It's people moving out gradually and in increments. And this is something that is actually exacerbated when you gentrify a neighborhood like the University District. So that would be my answer.
All right. Well, quickly, the media is making play of North Korea as saying that it has nukes.
Yes, it is. And this is something that people who follow North Korea are taking a whole lot less seriously than the media is, because we've talked about this on this program before, where North Korea has a long history of negotiating vis-a-vis bluster. I'll keep this short because I know we don't have much time left. But North Korea... has a history of blustering its way and bluffing its way in negotiations, and then at the last moment giving way and making compromise. And then we saw this with North Korea's threat to withdraw from the non-proliferation treaty in the early 90s, which led to Clinton signing in 1994 with the previous agreement with North Korea. And this is something we're going to see more of as the Bush administration takes a hard line with North Korea. North Korea withdrew from the six-party talks, but its venom seems to be primarily reserved for the United States and the hardliners in the Bush administration. So, unless we can get some sort of compromise out of Bush as well, and he did throw them an olive branch by not mentioning North Korea in an axis of evil type context in the State of the Union address. So that was one semi-positive sign that he didn't take time to single them out the way he routinely has in the past. But that being said, we're going to be seeing much more of this in the future, I'm afraid.
All right. We are talking with John Parrish. He is co-editor at Eat the State. And, John, where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It is a local newspaper that covers local as well as national and international news. You find it where you find free newspapers around town at bookstores and cafes and places like that. You can also find the paper and contact us online at www.eatthestate.org. All of our past issues as well as our current issue is online. Also volunteer opportunities to donate. If you want to help out by writing for us or researching or helping to distribute or sell ads or any of those kind of things to help support independent journalism in Seattle, we'd love to have you. So look us up. www.eatthestate.org.